Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to get started with our conversation. I'm Margot Stedman. I'm the Education and Community Engagement Director for the Rockford Symphony. So I'm just delighted that we're all back together. I know this is an event I always look forward to. And in the past, we've had Steve, of course, interviewing our guest artists. And we're moving forward. We'll have a slightly different format. Today we have, I'm sure you recognize behind me, Mark Baldwin, our principal trumpet. And he is going to be leading a conversation today with Yaniv Attar, who is our first finalist. So, yes, he's right behind me. I know you all will enjoy this a lot. We've all enjoyed having Yaniv in town this week and getting to spend time and know him. And I know this will be special for you all to get to know a little bit about him, too. Mark has some questions he'll be asking him. But, of course, as always, it's a have a little bit of a conversation format. So we'll have time for you all to ask your questions and to participate towards the end. So without further ado, I'm going to go sit down and turn this over to Mark and Yaniv and let you all enjoy your lunches. Thank you again for being here.
Thank you, Margot. Yes, I'm, as she said, Mark Baldwin, principal trumpet. I'm the one in the back row whose occasional job is to make the first three rows of the orchestra irrelevant.
And he's doing a pretty good job at it.
When called upon, it is my pleasure to be here and talk with Yaniv, having worked with him so far this week on the Tchaikovsky and Rodrigo in that. And I would, please. I thought we'd just start with a question that I learned a long time ago as an interviewer. I used to be a radio announcer back in the dim, dark past. And when interviewing someone that I don't really know, a great question to start kind of is, in a way, what's your story? Where do you come from?
So I was born in Israel. Feels like many years ago. But I was born in Israel. My parents actually originally are from Morocco. They were Moroccan Jews, and they immigrated to Israel in the late 60s. That's where they met. And I was born in Israel, and I lived there until I was 18, which was army age, and I managed to get out of it. And then I went to London. I studied at the Royal College of Music, guitar and conducting. I'm a classical guitarist. That's my instrument. And then after that, I moved to New York City, where I was studying at the Juilliard School with a soloist that actually you've been here before, Sharon Isbin, guitarist some of you may know by name. So then I decided to finally focus solely on conducting. That's when I moved to Montreal, Quebec. I was at McGill University. And I did another master's there in conducting, and then I stayed there for the doctorate. And then the first job I got was the assistant conductor of the Alabama Symphony Orchestra in Birmingham. So we moved south, and it was very different. All I knew in the U.S. from before was just New York City. So I think everything besides New York City is different. And after Birmingham being assistant there, my first job that I won as music director was in Bellingham, Washington, which is just between Seattle and Vancouver, actually closer to the border with Vancouver, Canada. So I'm the music director of the Bellingham Symphony Orchestra, and I have another orchestra, a chamber orchestra in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania Chamber Orchestra. So I commute between the two. And I'm also involved with an orchestra in Tacoma called Northwest Sinfonietta, and that's a very unique position. They decided they don't want to deal with music directors because we're divas. So what they did instead, they have artistic partners. So basically they have two artistic partners that, you know, stay for either one term, which is 3 years, and if they like them, they stay for another term, and then probably will rotate. So this is my second term. So at least they liked me for the first term. That's good news. So that's in Tacoma. So it's not so far from my house. And here I am in Rockford, Illinois, trying out for your orchestra, wonderful orchestra, if I may add.
So if the orchestra doesn't want a music director because they're divas, they obviously don't have any trumpets in the orchestra.
That's true.
No brass. That's what I thought.
No brass in general.
What brought you to music initially? What excited you about music, and what excited you about the guitar?
I don't come from a musical family. None of the people in my immediate family are musicians, so I'm the black sheep, if you want to say. And you know, my mom wanted me to be able to play an instrument. She raised us on her own. You know, single mom. So she couldn't really afford an expensive instrument, and she thought, "Oh, I'll buy him a guitar, and he'll play some chords by the fire pit, and call it a day." And she bought me a guitar. I went for my first guitar lesson, and the teacher picked up the guitar. You know, he wanted to first tune it because it was, you know, no, I haven't played it before. So he was tuning it, and as soon as he finished, he played. I didn't know what it was, but he played an Allemande from one of the Lute Suite by Bach. And the antennas in my ears just froze or perked or whatever you want to call it. And I just said, I have to learn this. And he said, well, you know, this is totally different kind of studying we need to. I said, I don't care. It doesn't matter. this is what first excited me about classical guitar and classical music in that sense. And then my sister in Israel, she studied at the Tel Aviv University. She was studying film. And one of her assignments at school, at university, was to analyze the soundtrack of Clockwork Orange, the Stanley Kubrick movie, which was totally inappropriate for a teenager. But what made me so obsessed with that movie was the soundtrack, which uses a lot of Beethoven Ninth Symphony, especially the scherzo. And my mom, I mean, she loves classical music. She, you know, we had records at home. Remember those big things that nobody else uses today?
I'm a collector.
Oh, so we had a record of Beethoven Ninth Symphony. And I must have played it 5,000 times because I totally destroyed that with the needle. But this was the first thing that opened my ears into orchestral music. And because of it, I started to listen to more orchestral music. My mom bought me a subscription for the hometown orchestra that we had, and I started to go there and really fell in love with orchestral music. I always say that I went into conducting, I think, totally by chance, because, you know, big part of the conductor is you tell other people what to do, and I hate telling other people what to do. but being a classical guitarist, and there's no classical guitar in orchestra, really the only path for me to be involved with that music making was conducting.
That's interesting you mentioned that Clockwork Orange, because when I was in 8th grade, 13, 14 years old, long before I ever saw the movie, I fell in love with the soundtrack to Clockwork Orange.
Oh.
bought the album and played it incessantly for a while. As a guitar player, you know, a lot of conductors, when you look at they come from the string family or pianists. There have been some have been trumpet players. Gerard Schwartz is one that comes to mind. But the conductors usually come down through the piano, string, or even guitar. What is it about? Well, you fell in love with the idea of being able to be in an orchestra, mm-hmm. and being a guitarist. Ain't much you can do there, you know.
Mahler 7, maybe.
Yeah, learn the mandolin and do the
exactly.
Festa Romana, you know.
There you go.
But where was it that you? Well, I guess you kind of answered the question. Where it was that you decided guitar is great, I love it, but I really want to be a conductor.
So when I was studying in London, a friend of mine who was already an established conductor. Started an orchestra. It was called the Tempest Chamber Orchestra, and he needed an assistant, you know, to help with balance and other things. And he said, "Would you be interested in joining?" And I said, sure. Obviously, I knew nothing. I was, you know, 19 at the time. And so he let me conduct one piece in the program in the first concert. And I will never forget my first rehearsal because I was conducting the Barber of Seville overture. So, you know, and of course I was so nervous. You know, you're standing in front of an orchestra for the first time. The first thing that was so crazy was, you know, as a guitarist, I always performed sitting down. And all of a sudden, I was standing in front of an orchestra and I had to stand up. And after I started conducting, I realized that one of my legs was shaking. At that point, I was just focusing, how do I not fall off the podium? But what was more astonishing for me to discover, you know, I conducted the piece, we got to the end, and then I realized that I haven't heard a single note because I was so busy with conducting that I wasn't really conducting the orchestra. I was, mm-hmm. you know, so, but, you know, as I started to get more relaxed and hearing what's coming from the orchestra and working with them and creating a product, it was an incredible feeling. And I said, you know, this is it. This is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's such a contrast because the guitar, I think of it as the most intimate instrument that you can think of. It's just so quiet and personal. And the orchestra, on the other hand, is one of the most powerful instruments that you can think of. So in that sense, I'm like, almost I have a split personality, mm-hmm. in a sense. But you know, Hector Berlioz actually was quite a good guitarist. And he always called the orchestra mon petit orchestre, my little orchestra. Hmm. Because there's such an incredible amount of colors and harmonies and melodies that you can do at the same time in a guitar that you, for example, cannot do with a violin, mm-hmm. or with a trumpet. Mm-hmm. Right. So in that sense, it is quite similar to piano, I feel, in terms of the understanding of harmony and melody, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. together.
Just as an aside, you still perform guitar as a guitarist?
You know, when I started to focus solely on conducting, it was after I won a big competition in guitar in Israel. And then immediately after that, I don't know how, things got so busy with conducting, I abandoned the instrument, which I regretted later very much. And what brought me back to the instrument was COVID, which I was very thankful for. All of a sudden, all orchestras canceled everything. And I had no instrument. I had no connection with sound. And I said, all right, I guess guitar it is. And I picked up the guitar. And it was very depressing because after many years of not playing, all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. But I really, do you say in English, dove? Like in past, yeah. That, yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Into it and practiced so much. I actually, in December... And in November, so with two orchestras that I work with, I conducted a concerto from the guitar. It was a guitar concerto. Actually, it's two guitar concertos. So it's by Roberto Sierra, mm-hmm. Called Fantasia Corelliana. And it was my first time conducting from the guitar. But the whole... And then I played with a quintet from the orchestra. We did the Boccherini Fandango Quintet. It was so much fun. I realized how I missed playing and making the sound. But I think more than anything else, I strongly believe that it's so important for a conductor to be really master of at least one instrument and feel like what it's like to be a performer. It really keeps you honest as a musician. And I feel, how do I have the right to tell musicians do this or do that, or if I can't do that, mm-hmm. on my own instrument. So I think, yeah, it keeps you very honest as a musician, and you know, you don't forget what it's like to be connected to sound, which is, you know, that's how what we breathe, what we live.
Mm-hmm. Moving from the individual to the orchestra as an instrument and as a force, if you will, or as something to communicate with. Where do you view the orchestra in society now? I bring that up only because, as a quick aside, I was playing a recital at a retirement home a year or so ago, and it's a program I put together of lighter stuff, some big band stuff and that. And afterwards, a lady came up to me, and I use this story with my students when I say, why do we do this? You know, as a musician, as an orchestral player, as an actor or whatever, you know, you're putting yourself in front of people. And trust me, on a trumpet, you can make a fool of yourself very loudly. And I have done it more than once. But a lady came up to me afterwards, and she said, I want to thank you. She said, I've been going through some pretty rough stuff in my life, and for the last hour and a half, you made me forget that. And there, to me, there is no greater achievement for a musician than to make a person for a little while feel better. Now, jumping that to an orchestra is perhaps a little silly, but just to start a conversation of how you see the orchestra in today's society and what an orchestra can do to branch out more and kind of give that experience to more people.
I don't think it's silly at all to compare it to an orchestra, because it's, I think in general, it's the how art and music in particular affects our life. It could be a piano recital, it could be an orchestra, it could be an opera, it could be a jazz concert, anything. And how art is used as a tool for healing, for community. And I think in many ways, to me, you know, aside from, I don't know if you've ever seen the TV show Mozart in the Jungle. And it's brings the life and the dramas that in the orchestra, and orchestras are full of drama. Anywhere you're going to put a big amount of people, you're going to have drama. But I think in many ways, to me, orchestra is almost a perfect model of what a society should be like. The most democratic way of, you know, when you look at impressionistic paintings, and, you know, you see all these dots and everything that makes the thing complete. And orchestra is kind of the same, because everybody has a little part, a little dot in making that perfect performance of this masterpiece. So I think in that way, it's really of how we should behave as a community, how we can be better community players, community members, to create something together. So that's one thing, but this is in terms of the orchestra. But, you know, an example that I like to do, a few years ago, I created a series in Bellingham called Harmony from Discord. And the series started as a series of music. Once a year, we would do a concert where we would play music that was written by composers who wrote under oppression. And it was mainly at this time when we started the series, for composers who died during the Holocaust. Some of the music we performed was actually even written in the camps during the war. Some of them was music that was banned by the Nazis to be played in Germany, in general, in Europe. Many composers who fled to the United States, like Korngold or Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, who was later the teacher of John Williams. And it was really important, I think, to teach how art as a tool can transcend oppression. And, you know, in many ways, I think this is still relevant to our days when we play that music. I think future of orchestras, when it comes to, you know, why they exist in society, is to be able to show us that music is relevant today. I don't think we can continue with the model of that a symphony orchestra is going to be a museum of works. basically, you know, we are going to play works from this year until whatever, 19 something, and by the same composers over and over. I mean, is this really how we are going to make a difference in the community? How are we going to show people that music is relevant today? And there are pieces written about social justice. There are pieces written about climate change. And these are things that affect us today. And there's a place in art, and especially for music, to be part of this. Can you imagine if in literature we would stop reading books written after a certain year? Or if we saw dance performances or theater of works that were written only until a certain time? I mean, we can't imagine art operating that way, and music should be no different.
How would you go about bringing that in a concrete way, in a concert, introducing more new works where at the same time, you know, there's a reason Beethoven's Fifth Symphony is still popular.
Yes.
You know, I mean, and I think we forget when we look at especially classical music that not all classical music was written in an ivory tower for people sitting in stiff collars. You know, a lot of it was written as dinner music.
Yeah.
I mean, a great deal of the great small ensembles of Mozart that we very piously listened to were written so you could do all this and talk while the string quartet was over here playing some nice background music. It just happened to be some of the best background music that was ever written. But, you know, these things aren't all, it was not all seriousness. So
you know,
how do you do that in bring that to a concert?
And just following what you said, you know, at Mozart's time or Beethoven's time, more in Mozart time than Beethoven. In Beethoven, there started to be a movement in music that music is eternal and could live forever. But in Mozart's time, for example, nobody was interested in what was written yesterday. An opera that you heard by Mozart 2 years ago, nobody wanted to go listen to. This was old. People were always interested in what was new. It's just totally different today. People want to hear what they know. They want to hear what they're familiar with. And, you know, the whole industry of recordings, I think, in many ways was wonderful, but in many ways was destructive. Because not only people wanted to hear what they know, they always compared it to the performance that they know. And say, okay, this is a good performance or not, because the CD I have at home with so-and-so presented it this way. But more to your question about presenting music that people don't know, and especially new music. And new music today has, you know, different kind of sometimes language that is different than what we used to in Brahms or Beethoven and all these things. And I think it's all about how you sell it. You know, there's contemporary music and there's contemporary music. My personal philosophy is that if you need to be a musicologist in order to appreciate a piece of music, then I'm not interested in presenting it to the audience, because not everybody are musicologists in the audience. So if I'm analyzing a piece by Schoenberg, which is, you know, in the 12-tone technique, and, oh, look at what he's doing here, and it's so clever because it's this line backwards, and if you listen to it and it doesn't connect to you as a person, then I'm not interested in presenting it. I can see the brilliance of it, but if it doesn't come across, and I think many contemporary composers today lost the human part of music that can connect to you no matter what. Things that Tchaikovsky had. There's, you know, you listen to some things in Tchaikovsky that we're going to perform and you have goosebumps, and it just goes into your body. And that was the magic of those composers. And there are great composers today who can do that. But when presenting piece to the audience that have some kind of significant, whether it's historical or whatnot, I always think it's the way you sell it to the audience and to the orchestra as well. And it's the same way. So I love somehow deconstructing the piece in concert in a short way. You know, people don't come to hear a lecture recital, but enough that the audience knows what to listen to, and it creates a totally different experience. I think the days of coming to the stage, conducting, and going backstage are over or should be over. And I'm glad that in America, actually much more than any country that I've seen, this is much more common. You don't see it. I know in Israel you don't see it. In Europe you don't see it. It's like, oh, the conductor. There's so many rules that come into don't clap between movements, cough only twice after a slow movement. I mean, I'm just kidding now. But it's just, there's no place for it. I don't think there's a place for it. We can learn a lot, I think, from jazz musicians and jazz concerts. You know, in Mozart's time, if they finished, if there was a cadenza and the player improvised, or if the first movement ended, and if the audience didn't clap, the composer would be offended. It's like, they didn't like it, you know. But today, you know, people clap after a movement, and then you have all these people like looking, oh, they don't know what they're doing.
Philistines.
Yes, I don't like it. That culture need to change. People don't need to be afraid to come to the concert hall with silly etiquette rules, and people come to have a moving experience. And if somebody's moved and they're clapping, great, we did something. If somebody's booing because they were bored with what we did, you know what? That's good too. I want a reaction from the listeners.
Moving kind of from the general into a little bit more of the specific.
Uh-huh.
How would you go about extending the reach of the symphony in Rockford? What have you done, say, in like Bellingham and others, to bring the orchestra to more people or to give it more exposure?
One of the things, I mean, you know, obviously having a big symphony orchestra is quite an expensive thing, so you can't take the orchestra everywhere. But we do send a lot of musicians in various sizes of ensembles everywhere in our county. We haven't done it further because we don't want to step on toes of other orchestras. But we do send the orchestra to many unusual places, locations where the orchestra can perform great music. It doesn't have to be orchestra. And hopefully gauging people's interest in what the orchestra is doing. It's another place for us to, you know, publicize what we're doing, what kind of programs we have. We send musicians to all the schools where we go to. Personally, something that I've done since I've been in Bellingham that I love doing is, I know here you bring the guest artists to this kind of setting so the audience can get to know them, but I also make a point of every guest artist, and it's in their contract, so you know, if they don't want it, they don't have to come, that we take them to schools, at least two schools in the county, where they would go to the assembly and play for the kids, talk to them. One of the great stories that I had a few years ago, I brought a wonderful cellist, Amit Peled, to play in Bellingham. We did Saint-Saëns, and he actually wrote a book because he used to play the cello of Pablo Casals. It was lent to him, and he played for quite a few years on it. And he wrote a book about it. So he played for the kids. He read the book, and then we had a discussion. I actually played some duets for cello and guitar with him. And, you know, one of the nicest things that we heard about after that assembly was the string teacher said that the next day, two parents called them, said they wanted to have some cello lessons. So these kind of little things of reaching out to the community everywhere is something that I I'm very passionate about.
What are the kind of things that you would personally do as a music director in the community? What kind of things do you do there in your other organizations?
I speak a lot in retirement center, Rotary clubs, places like this. Usually it's before a concert. I would tell them, you know, what's our next program. If I can, I usually bring the guest artist with me. And again, we can play or talk. And I think it's just getting the word out there that the symphony is doing great things, and it's worth coming. Because, you know, experiencing live music is just nothing like it. And I'm always amazed, even when the marketing is so active, that people sometimes just don't know. I mean, we live in an age where people are bombarded with information all the time. It's the radio, it's the TV, it's the emails, it's you get promotions for so many things. I think people disconnect to survive. I see the music director as a very important tool for the organization to get the word out there through various, like, speaking in places or going to schools or you know, any marketing efforts to help the symphony fulfill its mission, but by getting the word out there.
What made you, aside from just, I need a job, what made you look at our, you know, our offering, saying we need a music director here in Rockford, Illinois, and piqued your interest?
Yeah, well, it was quite by coincidence. I don't even remember where it was advertised, but I didn't see it. Totally slipped my radar. And then one day, two musicians that I respect a lot, one who played in this orchestra and doesn't anymore, and one is a soloist who played with the Rockford Symphony, I think in 2012, he told me. And they just said, hey, we heard that the Rockford Symphony is looking for a music director. You should really check it out. It's a wonderful orchestra. They have a beautiful theater, great community. Check them out, which I did. I went to the website. I went to social media. Creepily went into the 990 of the orchestra to see what's the size of the board, what kind of financial contribution they get from the through grants, through fundraising. Wanted to see anything that I could learn about the orchestra, and I was really impressed with everything that I saw. And I said, this is an orchestra that has so much growth over the years. It's really impressive from, the way they started, you know, years ago. I mean, obviously, online, you can only go that far back. But looking at the tenure of Maestro Larsson, and how much growth it has in the 30 years that it's been here, and it's really amazing. I knew that all of us are going to be auditioning for big shoes. And truly, I actually met with Maestro Larsson a few days ago. We had dinner, and I had such a lovely time with him. And I told him, it's really an honor for us to audition for your spot, and we respect so much what you have done, not just for the orchestra, but for the city of Rockford. It just looked like a wonderful organization that I felt I have something to bring to the table. I feel that, you know, of course, personally, I felt I could grow as a musician working with this orchestra. And that's something that I think conductors always need to pay attention to. You know, is it some place that I could give something? Is there a place that I can grow? Because I don't see it as selfish, but it's natural, you know. An orchestra is an instrument for us as conductors, and I saw a nice instrument. And I thought, all right, let's give it a go. So me, together with I don't know how many hundreds of people, you had to sift through. This is there you go.
Trust me, 208.
That's a lot of application to go through.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad I don't have that job, but I'm honored and humbled that you trusted me enough to come and audition for the position.
Just a final few comments before we open it up to questions. Is there anything more? Maybe you covered this all, but what do you see the orchestra doing going forward? Perhaps in a specific and also a more general aspect.
I think in general, I would love to have the orchestra perform different kind of concerts. It's not the whole season, of course. But for example, something that I really enjoyed doing in Bellingham, just to be specific in that sense, to create concert experience that is not just going to be the usual first half, second half, guest artist, 7:30, we come to the concert, we go home. So, for example, in Bellingham, we have this series that is called Symphony in Jeans, which basically it means that the orchestra gets to wear jeans for the concert. We don't all look like penguins in the concert hall. And there are short concerts, no intermission. And it could be a really obscure program or it could be a really light program. We really encourage younger people to attend as well by giving special discounts and stuff. And I think the whole thing of the Symphony in Jeans helps. And then we have a big reception for people who want to attend, and we have drinks there and people mingle. And I think the social part of it is almost just as important. And people can, you know, hopefully talk about what they were excited and the musicians come and interact with the audience for those things. It's a different type of concert experience. We don't do it like all year, but we do a couple of those a year, and they're very successful. And a lot of things I think that you will do as an organization, of course, it's always involves taking risks. And it doesn't always have immediate results that you want. But I think it's important to be persistent if you believe in that goal. Just as another example, and I said it in one of the other interviews I had while I was here, when we started the Take a Teen program where if you're an adult buying a ticket, you can bring a teen for free. We had a sponsor that was very passionate about having younger people in the audience. And when we started the program 8 years ago, you know, we had 7 or 8 people in the first concert, 20 in the next one, 50 in the next one. Today we have about 200 to 300 teens come to each of our concerts for free. We don't suffer financially from it because the sponsor covers that. We had somebody that, you know, wanted to do that. But we expose a lot of young people to classical music, and that's great. But it didn't happen like this. These are things that happen over time, and if an organization is willing to take risks, I think it's a very healthy thing. Doesn't always work, but it's, you don't know until you try.
Okay, now it's your turn. Questions? Sir, please.
With that team we were talking about, was it usually the parents that brought one of their children, or let's say we don't have any kids at home, we'd like to take a team, can we volunteer and they can tell somebody at a local high school you can go with?
It was both ways. We had somebody, you know, people bring either their grandchildren or, you know, a kid of one of their neighbors, you know, they wanted to bring some Take a Teens, people who bought tickets and said, you know, we reached to high schools and said, you know, we have this amount of tickets. If you want to send students, please sign up and we'll have a certain amount of tickets. So it was through many avenues that we explored that. It wasn't just like you bringing your kids.
School or?
For college, we have special we call it rush hour tickets, and we started recently. And I think I've heard that Rockford Symphony did it too. Open the dress rehearsals, so we do that too for people who can, you know, either attend for free or at a very minimal price. Usually, when we have choral concerts, they usually sell out, you know, months in advance. And then we have a ticketed dress rehearsal, but for, you know, very like $5. And then we figured how many families usually come. That was a revelation, how many families came to the dress rehearsal, because, you know, it's a situation when you can come, you learn about what's happening behind the scene, you see the performance, but you're also free to come as go and go as you wish, which I think with families and kids, it's important to have that flexibility.
Anybody? Yes, ma'am.
Who are some contemporary American composers that you would like to profile?
I love the music of Jonathan Leshnoff. He's a wonderful composer based in Baltimore. Atlanta Symphony and Baltimore Symphony premiered many of his works. And I think he's one of these composers that really did not lose the ability to connect to the listener in such a quick way, same way that you would connect to Tchaikovsky. He's one composer. I think Jessie Montgomery, she writes really great music. Gabriella Elena Frank, I think, writes wonderful music. I premiered a few pieces by Sharon Farber, she's a composer based in LA, who writes really wonderful music. And again, I think their music is what I see is the future of classical music, much more than Schoenberg or Berg or other composers that will write clever music with lots of effects that I don't think necessarily can connect to an audience.
Anybody else? Well,
no tricky questions.
Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoyed the meal. You know, come back. We'll be here again next week. Enjoy the veal. Tip your server. I want to thank Yaniv. Thank you very much for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you. And I want to thank personally, not just to the orchestra, but to everybody at Rockford that, you know, these are definitely challenging times. Especially, I think, for the arts, as people struggling with health issues and COVID and all this. But I feel grateful that we can do a concert and make music in these challenging times. So thank you for making me feel so welcomed. And most importantly, thank you all for your incredible support of your Rockford Symphony, because they're amazing. They're a jewel in this community. I don't need to tell you this. And I'm just happy to be part of this journey for you.
And on a personal note, keep coming to the concerts and bring all your friends, because the growth in the orchestra. I've been in the orchestra. This is my 42nd season. Yes, I was 4 years old when I started. Thank you. Just on a personal note, if I may. To say the orchestra has grown is an understatement. And to have been a part of this for this long, and it's been really very, very special. And you hear a lot of orchestras and a lot of other orchestras of our type, our size, our budget, our number of concerts and that. And, you know, I've heard, and yeah, we're one of the best of them. We really are. And I'm not just saying, you know, just because I'm in it or that. We are. We're a good orchestra. So, you know, keep coming to the concerts, because it's no fun for us. One of my catchphrases has always been is we play instruments. We play in an orchestra. It's no fun if we don't have anyone to play with. And you are the people we play with. So, see you on Saturday. Take care.